It wasn't
similar.
until I fully stopped following the algorithms and I said no that I was able to get this book out of me. It was only then.
Welcome to Actual People, a podcast hosted by me, Chauncey Zulkin, dedicated to meaningful conversations about the evolving landscape of our lives and the power of our own creativity and imagination to make magic. Jessica Elefante, like me, worked in strategy for advertising and branding and marketing. She broke free from a very successful career on paper that just wasn't working for her. Her work was mostly centered around crafting digital influence. It was the digital marketing and the constant connectedness that did her in. She wrote a book about it, which is both a personal journey as well as a kind of how to get away from technology, how to get away from that influence. The book she wrote is called Raising Hell and Living Well, Freedom from Influence in a World Where Everyone Wants Something from You, Including Me. I'm so excited to share this conversation, and one of the reasons is because it differs from how I thought it would go. Where I was thinking about agency culture, which kind of clamps down on your creative spirit, her focus has been on the toxicity of digital influence overall. It gave me an even deeper understanding of the way digital influence contorts our lives as creatives, as people having autonomy and making decisions for ourselves, in the way we have agency over our lives or don't. Let's jump in.
Ah, there you are.
Look at
Hi.
that room that you're in.
This is a co-working design studio, and this is their little room that I've taken over for all of my podcasts. It's awesome.
I remember the first time I was ever on a podcast, I was in my closet.
Oh, yeah.
The host told me to go in the closet. So I was like, with all my clothes around me in the closet. We've had different careers. Mine comes from advertising, brand strategy, account planning in the agency, trauma from that. Three different agencies. It was this great job and I hated it.
Same. Yep.
Part of the inspiration for the whole podcast was, if we're so creative, why are we all working in the marketing department? And then I heard about your book and I was, oh my God, this is a kindred spirit, because this is something I grapple with my whole entire life.
Life. Yeah. The fact that we're creative in a society based off of capitalism. So we commodify our art to be able to pay the bills for somebody else. And we don't ever do the thing that we set out to do. I sold my soul. At the time, very similar to you, it was a cool job. It was cool to work in branding and marketing because I was not a lawyer. I was not an accountant. I was throwing big fancy parties or coming up with creative visuals or the lexicon for a new brand. I was doing all these cool and fun things.
It's really fun. It is fun.
It is fun until it's not. I don't want to blame marketing or advertising or even brands per se, but these organizations that benefit from this sort of structure are just going to take. There is never any end point. There is never enough. And when that is the goal, they are also going to do that to their employees and their employees' creativity and their employees' mental health, everything in marketing, advertising, and branding. It's like, up here, right? It's up in the air. It's up in the ether. It's not something that, you know, people have KPIs they try and quantify, but there can always be more. I guess even if it was physical products, there can always be more. So I finally just got so incredibly fed up.
Like, what was the turning point for you?
The first one was, I was a digital strategist. I wasn't supposed to be a digital strategist. I was just a creative director and also a strategist. But then this was the heyday of the internet and utilizing it for marketing, and people didn't know what to do. So I just kind of went into that role. And because I could speak in terms that the C-suite was accustomed to, newspapers, billboards, traditional yellow pages advertising, I was able to explain to them why a Facebook page might make sense for them and how to put money behind it. And so I just ended up taking off. I didn't try to have this career, it just happened. It's this idea that yes, I can do those things because I'm entrepreneurial. Yes, I can fill that role. Yes, I could make this go viral. Yes, I could do all these things. But should I, right? And the should I is against now my understanding of my values and the things I want to hold true to in this much later phase of my life. So I don't want to jump ahead, but long story short, I was operating all the social media accounts, all the websites, building out the wireframes for e-commerce, all customer service for multiple brands, communicating in real time on behalf of them all, because there's no such thing as boundaries with your boss or with work or clients or anything like that. And so, as all of this was taking off between 2010 and 2015, I started to feel really, really unwell in my brain, and I didn't know what it was. The most terrifying thing was memory loss and brain fog, not remembering kind of how I was spending my days, my weeks, my months. And I went to all these different doctors. No one could figure out what it was. I was in my early 30s. They take my blood work and they're like, "You're healthy as a horse," you know? So there's no reason for me to have any of these real issues. I went on vacation with my now ex-husband and my son. And when we landed, of course, because I was fully addicted to my work and identity around it, I texted all of my clients, no Wi-Fi on the plane. We had gone to Hawaii for a wedding. And he was like, "Yeah, I'm not doing this with you. You can either take the vacation I know you put in for with all of your clients, telling them you'd be offline, or I'm sending you home." That was actually a blissful 2 weeks after I stomped my feet, cried, shame, anger, all of those things. It was because of this vacation that I realized what was wrong with my brain, because 8 days later, it was like a light switch went on and my brain came back fully functioning. I came back to New York and sat with a boss client at the time and said, "I'm going to keep my computer closed and I'm going to take notes with a pen and paper because that's how I've done it my whole life. And I actually remember it better." And they were like, "What are you doing? You're our digital strategist. Open your computer, open the Twitter feed, open this." And it was in that moment I was like, "Oh, I can't protect myself in this environment. And I definitely can't change this environment right now. But I could do it outside of here." And so I walked out, I quit on the spot, and then started Folk Rebellion, which was this crusading media brand that was all around the concept of how we were using our technology was likely not the best or most healthy way. I really truly believed that we could have a good relationship with it through awareness, hacks, tips, tricks, boundaries, balance, mindfulness, all the things I went out on to tout for almost a decade afterwards. I had an online community that was very large. We did retreats, off-the-grid retreats all over the world. I took people to the Northern Lights up near the Arctic Circle. I went to Mexico, went to the Adirondacks. We went to Greece, all off the grid to get people to reconnect to themselves and the idea that this wasn't the best way.
Let me stop you
Yeah.
because, first of all, there's also a parallel. I envy you because I had like drawings of starting a retreat center after going to Kripalu and a lot of writers' workshops. I want to do kind of this hybrid thing. How did you do it? How did you get people to find out about what you did? Because now
This.
you're trying to get away from technology, but you need technology.
So, I firmly believe this. You have to fish where there's water, right? So, I still use the internet in this way. I don't like to be on the internet. I actually think it's a dumpster fire, and I don't think it's healthy for us at all. And I don't think any of this stuff is built for the human in mind to have a healthy relationship with it. And I don't actually think that that can change until the foundations of how they're built is changed, which is very different than what I said for 10 years with Folk Rebellion. And I really did believe it. I wasn't tricking people. I believed it myself. Today I'm on the other side. But I used my marketing 101. I mean, what I did is I built lifestyle brands, and I knew that nobody wanted to be told they were scrambling their brains or their kids' brains. No one wanted to talk about tech not being amazing, because you have to realize in 2014, we were sucking at the fire hose of innovation. These sort of frat boy dropout hoodie, make billions of dollars. Everyone wanted to be the next, you know, "I'm Uber for this. I have a VC meeting. Oh, I'm pitching my company." For me to say this was crazy. So I had to do it in this counterculture way. I had to make it rebellious. That's where the word rebellion comes in. I had to make it nostalgic so that people tapped into something they missed or remembered. This was all marketing stuff. I chose this on purpose to be super strategic, just to get people to think about their relationship with their phones. Instead of creating educational content and curriculums, I created t-shirts that said "Wonder where the Wi-Fi is this week," just so they actually started to think about this culture of always being on. Now, there are pieces of it that I wish I had done differently. I did want to have a curriculum and an educational component, but nobody was ready for it at the time. And by the time they were, which is today, I was burnt and I decided to just live the way that I was advocating for. And so I guess kind of that's where this book comes in, because I hadn't fully deconstructed why I was the way I was and the influences I was under. So I thought it was just tech and digital, but then I create this whole other company and mission that's mine and I can do whatever I want with it. But I still flew coast to coast, back to back, multiple speaking engagements in a row. I still fell for the giant brands coming in, wanting to sponsor me, partner with me, but then steal all of my ideas. I was still swimming with the sharks.
Somehow it sucks you back in and you're still part of it because that's your framework for understanding. I'm still trying to figure this out. I have this podcast. I really care about it. I enjoy doing this. I don't want to do TikTok. I don't want to do Instagram. I have like 11 followers on those platforms or zero on TikTok because I can't stand it at all. I can't handle it at this point at all, the short form. I like this because it's I can dig deep into a topic and that interests me. Having this podcast and being able to have an excuse to write deeply is a happy place. But once I start to have to pick up my phone, I feel nauseous and exhausted.
It's very difficult to be able to do the thing you love and pay the bills in this sort of structure of which we exist. The way that I work is I observe, research, and am quiet for a really long time because I'm thinking. I'm thinking, I'm thinking, I'm taking notes, I'm jotting down post-its everywhere, I'm observing, I'm researching, writing little missives. I don't need to be consuming all this other content and all these other people's things during that time, because that's what allows me to create the thing, whether it's a film, whether it's a book, whether it's an art installation or a newspaper. I need time. That is just how I work. Some people are not like that. They're more prolific. They can create all day, every day. I am not. I am very quiet for a long time, and then I create this very substantial thing. You're talking about operating within the dopamine culture. They want you to just keep feeding the machine.
But the
And
thing is, you might
it's
have a big public. How do you keep that? I don't. How
that's
do
okay.
you do what you love and your craft? I write fiction too. I have four books. I have a lot. I've done a lot, but it's not seen the light of day because that dopamine stuff takes up so much energy. So how do you actually get it out? Because I feel that pressure. I wish I was a welder in a way where it was very concrete what I
Yes.
did. But
Yes.
if you're creating cultural capital, how do you connect with people so that you have an audience and so that you can get paid basically and
Yeah.
still keep yourself separate from that dopamine hamster wheel?
You have to pick and choose your battles. There's a great book out right now by Cal Newport, who I love. It's called Slow Productivity. And it's all about this idea of in this culture that is constantly rewarding this digital currency of connection with, let's say you're an author, of always being connected and uplifting all the other authors and always consuming and saying, what is the thing of the moment right now? And it's creating all of this distraction and busyness. So you can't take the time to do deep, long, on purpose.
I'm reading Deep Work right now.
Oh, okay. So this is his next one. He actually came out with it after the pandemic because he started to see creatives and intellectuals and people who think for a living retaliating against productivity culture. What the book is all about is how he will do way less than what other people do. He will maybe write two or three really deep, well-researched op-eds that he's worked on for a year or two to promote his book, as opposed to doing 85 Substack interviews. Instead of reaching out to, 900 journalists, I chose five that I wanted to really read this book and potentially befriend. And so I focused on five and I really focused on them. And that meant if I show up at their event in real life when they have their own book come out, I'd much rather spend my time doing that, going and doing that for 6 hours of my day than spending 6 hours of my day just half-assing, liking, commenting, sharing stuff that it's just like, it's like it disappears so quickly. It's about that substance. It's about going deep. As far as like building an audience, he said, one, I don't think if you want to write a book, I don't think you need that anymore. I think they're understanding that, yes, if you have 500,000 followers, could you sell a book tomorrow? Of course. But if the writing is good or the concept is good, it's not going to hurt you if you don't have one. So pick your poison, pick the thing that you love the most. If you love podcasting, do podcasting, but be super intentional about it and set up a system where it's Cal Newport would say is like, okay, do all your recording on this day. You work on your graphics on this day and you batch them and you post them on this day. And then you're done with it. You're not constantly doing it. Now, my community, I have been joking that I've been trying to burn my Instagram account to the ground ever since I got that blue check because I don't use it and I hate it. And when I'm on it, I don't actually comment back to anybody. I don't operate in the way that the algorithm wants me to, but it's been amazing for finding like-minded people and then trying to move those relationships offline as quickly as possible. And so, anyone who
I
covered
like
my
that.
book, we met for coffee. And if we couldn't meet for coffee, I met them for a drink or something when they came to town. So, these were not passing friendships, or you do me a solid, I'll do you a solid. They know my kid's about to go in the hospital and they're texting me saying, do you want to stay at my house while you're in town? These are people who I met on Instagram who maybe interviewed me for the book, but now our relationship goes so much deeper than that. And so, as much as the culture of the internet and these apps and even media wants you to think that you have to jump through all the hoops, you can pick your poison. Go deep and be very strategic. And that is what I am sticking to because I did, for the first time in my life, create something I'm very, very, very proud of. I launched it and put it out in the world in a way that protected my boundaries, that didn't make me chase carrots that were success to somebody else, but not myself. Today's the 6 month anniversary of it coming out. And
Congratulations.
thank you. I feel really great about it. I didn't do the thing that I did two other times, which was burnout and follow other people's ideas of success and opportunity. Success to me this time was something entirely different. And yes, was I able to pay my bills? Yes, because I got this deal, but only because I worked so hard on it for so many years, researching this, So that would be my advice. Not that I'm in the business of giving advice, but you and I have similar backgrounds. And so
Yeah, so
it wasn't
similar.
until I fully stopped doing anything for anyone else and stopped following the trends or the algorithms, and I said no, that I was able to get this book out of me. It was only then. And then, of course, the book I write about my work in marketing and advertising, so I can never work in it again. My husband goes, you literally just set fire to your whole career. I went, I did.
I do th that kind of thing though too. I really admire that. I mean, I have a close friend that brought me into advertising in the first place that I met back when I was like smoking cigarettes and we were at a Angel Orsatz Foundation for a fashion show. And he was like, oh, smoke. And I was like, lighten up, it's fashion week or whatever. And we became friends. And then he's like, oh, you do insight and research trend stuff. And he brought me in. He makes everything seem so exciting, like a pack of Trident gum. So interesting. I ended up getting a job in advertising eventually, like in-house after being a consultant. And we were speaking recently, and I talked about you and in your book. He also wants to get out of it in a way, and he is kind of out of it. Or what do I do now? And everything's in upheaval. All these creative fields that are feeding the capitalist machine, they're now having a reckoning, even if they don't want to, because the financial models are crumbling. Money is the chain around a lot of our necks. I talk to people who are like, oh, I just completely changed my life and I got a new career. I'm like, but
You're like,
what about the
how?
money? Unless you have a
Oh
lot of
no.
money sitting around.
Here's the thing. There's this idea that authors make a bunch of money when they sell their book. That's not true unless you're Stephen King. An advance helps depending on the size, right? But I worked for 2 years before I sold my book. I worked for 2 years on that proposal before I finally got through every gatekeeper to say yes. And then they break the payments up, 4 payments, but it's over 2 years, another 2 years. It's crazy, right? I'll be honest with you. You max out credit cards, you borrow from friends. I sold some furniture that was collecting dust. I did odd jobs. I used to be a bartender. I said to my husband, I can't take this anymore. I can't have the stress of not having enough money and the stress of finishing this manuscript at the same
Yeah.
time. I'm going to go get a bartending job a couple nights a week. He went, oh, yeah, that's really going to help the creative flow when you're like exhausted, tired. But you do, you just have to cobble it
See, I haven't done
together.
that. I'm
And
always, I'm going to go get a job at a bookstore, but I don't do
right.
it. There's so many
Yeah.
times I wish I had done that kind of thing, but I'm like too much of a snob or something.
I'll tell you this, it's good for ideas too. So even if you're walking freaking dogs, like while you're walking, you're thinking, right?
Yeah.
So there is this whole piece of being a creative in, an artistic or a media space that requires observation and thinking. And without time to do that, which the internet does not allow for that, then the ideas I think are kind of surface level. And so to If
Absolutely.
you th if you think you're being a snob about it, think of it as this is research, right? I'm gonna go and I'm
And
gonna
it is
walk a dog,
research. Yeah, I
right?
like
Save
that.
the,
I actually
yeah.
want to paint murals in bedrooms because I did that for my own kids and I'm kind of good at it. I want to go do something thing, but yeah, it's real
One thing
hard to.
always unlocks the other, I think. One and it's but it's not easy. It's not easy at all. It's not financially easy. Yeah, my ex-husband will say, I can't believe what you did. I was really on the up and up. I was making boku bucks. Like I really, really was. And I was also stupid and I didn't save enough. And but it
Well, you
didn't
live in New York
matter.
City, don't you?
Right. Yeah. But it
Hi,
doesn't
New York.
matter because I was miserable and unhealthy and my relationships were unwell and I wasn't doing the one thing I wanted to do, which was write a book. So I could have had all the freaking money in the world, but I was still miserable. And so
Because that's
now,
someone else's idea of
yeah,
success. And it's kind
exactly.
of like a siren song
Yes.
focus.
Yes. And I said, I'm like, they're like blockers. I'm blocking everyone who wants, oh, I have this idea for you. Oh, you should do this. Oh, I have someone who you could work with them on this. And I was like, no one can come in until I do this. And now here's the cool thing. I did set fire to my marketing and advertising career and branding and all of that, but that brain is still there. I just want to like let it loose sometimes, but I won't. But there is an area where it really works. Another friend of mine who's an author works with people who want to write books, who are very talented and they're creators, and she helps them develop their book proposals. She's like, have you ever thought of helping people in their art? So that's what I do now. So that is one of the ways that I actually, outside of the book itself, make a pretty steady income. I work with writers or wannabe writers and help them position themselves, the market, their audiences, figure out the strategy for when would be a good time to launch. I don't do any of their marketing for them. This is just in their nonfiction book proposal so that they can
Yeah.
get their books sold. And I love it because I'm really good at it and it's easy and I could do it all day, but it's helping someone else achieve their dream. It's not
See, that's
helping a
this is why
corporate.
it's about helping people with their deep work. And it
Yes.
is, even if you're, a very creative person or even a great writer, having someone outside of yourself.
That's what I always tell people. Everyone has so much shame around this. I worked with three different people on this, like meaning it was all my writing. It was all my words. It was, but there was somebody there that I would go, do you see a thread here? Am I crazy? What is this? And they go, oh yeah, actually it's this. You need a collaborator in that way. All of my friends and colleagues who are authors also work with people. One of the things that I put on my credit card when I didn't have enough money to pay for it, but it worked out because I sold the book.
Yes. Well, that's because you did everything in service of your goal and your interest. It doesn't happen overnight, though. That's the thing. You do
No.
have to stick with something. So you better pick something that you really, that it's not ego-driven. I started an Etsy shop last summer because I love design, but I am not a designer. I opened an Etsy shop and it was a total failure because I don't make anything. It was such a cautionary tale. I bought a course from some charlatan who tells you how to create your Etsy shop and I followed her over a cliff.
She said, go to Hobby Lobby and buy stuff and spray paint it gold. And I'm like in the Hobby Lobby, like, what? Because I had created a line of greeting cards. And all of a sudden, I'm about to buy spray paint. But I have that story now. And then
Right.
I was going on podcasts and I'm like, I love this. This is my jam. I love this. It's a way to write, but make it verble
Yes. So
and to
follow
meet
that.
you and to, you know, like
Right.
meet
Well, and that's the
people.
other thing, right? It gives you community, and it allows you to connect with people in a way that you fills you up. It feels good, and maybe inspires you all yourself or your listeners. Like, that's what you want to do. I mean, it's hysterical that you wanted to do the Etsy shop because you were creatively driven to make the cards, but then you were just buying stuff in Hobby. Like, that's what I mean of out. So that's what the book is. It's all about the influence of other people, other things, of culture at large. Once you start to see and look at the person who sold you the course, like, what influences are they under? What influence are they wielding? Like, what do they want me to do? Well, is that what's best for me? Is that what I want to do? Is that what I set
Absolutely.
up? Right. So
Because
that's
people stop
kind of,
trusting themselves or even knowing themselves, even very self-possessed people, like we lose ourselves.
yeah, I think that has something to do with the technology too. I really do. I'm working with Mothers Against Media Addiction. Julie Skelfo started it. It's kind of like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but it's all around phones and social media for these kids and the mental health crisis. And I'm co-chair for the Brooklyn chapter. And one of the things that I'm finding is that the parents are like, I want the phones out of school, or I want the ed tech out of this library, but how? What do you mean how? You call the school, send them a letter, you ask for a meeting. What do you mean how? Well, what do I say? What do you mean? What do you say? We're the parents. You say whatever you want. You say you don't want it in there because it's not healthy, because you can't protect them, because there's no privacy, because you can say anything. But there's a sense of that they forgot that they're the adults in the room.
Or agency,
And
yeah.
yeah, we've spent the past decade or two consuming all of this stuff. We've been lulled into submission. We have choice here. We have agency. We can say and do and change things. And
I grew up in Miami, and a lot of my friends were Latin, and they had to have chaperones on dates. Sisters and siblings had to go out with you and that kind of thing. But the non-Latin kids didn't have to have that, but they were still friends and they still had their rules. So it's like, why can you just say your kid can't have a phone until they're in whatever grade? My kids are 10, so I know that I don't completely understand yet what happens. I had a friend tell me over spring break that I grew up with, that their kids had Snapchat, and not having Snapchat, they didn't know where the party was. But I have signed that 8th grade thing. And I just
good.
think, can't I just make that decision that they don't get the
You
phone?
can, but the problem is if they're the only one not doing it, then they're left out, like your friend said. So the way to do it, and what we're all working on, is collective buy-in or collective actions. My son, he's 12 right now. He has one other friend who they have the same phone. It's a dumb phone. He has no social media. If you get five families or five of the close friends or even three to say, we're not doing this, then they aren't missing out. They have someone else there. Something's shifting right now in culture. I'm super hopeful for the first time since I started Folk Rebellion in 2014. The ailments I was experiencing, which would today be called digital dementia, everybody's experiencing, right?
Digital
And
dementia. I've never heard of digital dementia. That's such a good term.
Manfred Spitzer, he's a neuroscientist. He coined it. That's exactly what I had. My number one symptom was word recall. I didn't discover the term until much later, but I had all the symptoms. And today, I think everybody has them. I go to something called, Alltech is Humans Responsible Tech Summit, where there's 7,000 people. You have the consulates from different countries showing up. You have young people who want to figure out how to make tech more responsibly. You have people saying, this can't be it. We are unwell, unhappy, unhinged. We don't own our time, and something has to change. We're at this watershed moment with AI. People are finally seeing where this could go. And therefore, they're raising their voices into collective action, saying, no, we don't want these in schools. No, I'm not going to be emailing at 2 o'clock in the morning. No, I do not want privacy settings on our TVs set to off. The next 18 months will really determine how we want to live alongside this technology. We're never going to put it back in the cage, but we can muzzle it, we can tie it down, we can train it, but we only have about that long. The creation of ChatGPT has now prompted an arms race from all these tech behemoths. Imagine a year and a half of deep fakes, of nudify cameras, of children being on these algorithms. Like,
of what cameras?
Nudify cameras. There's the Nudify app where you can take a photo of a person and you can nudify them. You can remove their clothes. Yes.
You mean like AI, what you think that they will
look? AI things. It's assaulting. It is horrifying.
Wow. I have never heard of this thing.
And now they have the camera.
What?
It's the prototype. So you don't even need, you could just buy the camera, walk down the street and take a photo, and it removes the person's clothes. So it's like a rape camera, essentially. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's also what porn does, where
it's
objectified, desensitized, dehumanized. I had an interview with Elise Hu, who wrote on K-Beauty. It's a parallel conversation about aesthetics, what she calls the cyborg gaze that we are under. Yeah. It used to be the male gaze that we were fighting against, and now it's the cyborg gaze, the tech gaze. We are removing our own humanity. That's why I call this actual people, because I'm starving and desperate to talk to people and to kind of cut the shit. I just want to cut the shit and talk about real things with no veneer. I'm 51. So I still have those remnants of real life. It does make us sick. My kids are young enough that there's still hope for them.
Right. We can change it. We have to.
Do you have any thoughts about, I just want to say one thing, which is that I went to London last summer, and when I landed, I went right to this meeting at Parliament that my friend invited me to. And it was nothing like I'd seen in the States. They were discussing their AI protocol. It was this ongoing paper. It almost felt like an academic paper. It almost felt quaint in its intimacy, this protocol that was developing in earnest. But what I was going to ask you is, what do you think about Gen Z and alphas turning away from technology?
I would say the late teens, early 20s are adopting flip phones or light phones. My friend Joe Hollier is the founder of Lightphone, the very stripped down phone that just makes calls and texts so that they can be present, because they do feel unwell. They are unhappy. They don't like always being connected. And so, yes, there is a bit of we're not going to do what our parents did. And they are going to swing a little bit the other way. I am hopeful there. The thing that I'm not hopeful about is I have a 12-year-old and I have a 2-year-old. So I've protected the 12-year-old like a crazy person. He was not allowed to have an email in elementary school, even though they kept trying to sign him up for one. He was not allowed any computers. I've done everything I can to protect him. He had no iPads, no video games, just wanted him to have this sort of 1980s, 90s childhood as much as I could in a world that didn't exist like that. And I was able to do it. And I'm super proud of where we're at. We haven't hit the horrifying teenage years yet. I may have another huge lesson to learn in the future, but we will see. For right now, I keep kicking that can down the road and it's been great. The reason I bring this up though is my 2-year-old. Now here we are a decade later. We know how unhealthy it's making everyone, how unhappy. And again, our society is so dysfunctional because of it. I am having a much harder time opting him out of this stuff, because in those 10 years, these companies were like robber barons into the very foundation of children's lives, of all of our lives. So his doctor's office has to have an app. His nursery school, I have to scan a QR code to drop him off. His data is being shared from one organization to another. Someone takes his photo and it's in their phone, and their phone is asking, who is this? So I cannot protect him in the same way, only because these very insidious sort of influences make money off him, have made it okay to be involved in his everyday life. And I am not okay with that. And so if there is a backswing and the kids don't want it, that's great. but we have as a society have made that significantly harder for them to do. Because even to get on the subway in New York City, you need a freaking phone. It's crazy to me. I take joy in telling people I can't do that. So I do it all day, every day, everywhere I go. Oh, scan this QR code for your menu. I can't do that.
Well, oh my God, you are hardcore.
And I go, I don't have a phone. And they go, you don't have a phone? I go, oh no, don't. I do. Well, I do. I have this flip phone now. I've made the jump officially.
Oh my God.
And they just look at me and then they walk away and they bring me the paper thing. I've told his school I will not scan him in. I have a flip phone. Anytime I can, like simple things. Like,
you know, I find it really hard to find a flip phone. My 10-year-olds want a flip phone. When I used to live in Europe, I would come to New York and get like a little flip phone. It was like $20. And then I would just discard it or I don't remember what I did. But I can't find one like that. I have to get on a plan.
I'm testing this one out. It's called a Cat, C-A-T, Cat, that brand.
Oh my God.
That's what it is. And it does have internet, but it is so painfully annoying to work on the screen that you don't do it. And it's literally been life-changing and I'm never going back.
I didn't realize this is such a huge part of your life, any sort of digital record, not just social media.
Because it's not just social media anymore. Everything is operating in that world of collect your data or collect your attention. And I can no longer, because of AI, determine where that data is going. The thing that scares me more than anything is I can no longer predict how this is going to be used and where it's going to end up. And so the only choice I have to protect myself or my children is to opt out of it. So at the 1-year anniversary of my book coming out, I will probably finally be closing the Instagram page.
So you'll just email people to connect with them or call them. So I think it would be interesting to kind of end this with a bulleted list. This is so social media. But I'd like to hear, what do you see now that you're talking about this nudie camera thing, which is freaking me out? What are some like big things to look out for, good and bad?
In regards to technology, you mean?
Yeah, technology or, you know, one of my big obsessions is what's going to happen with the creative industries because of all these massive layoffs. It's been very, very difficult for people. People thrive off creativity. That's, you know, the main point of being alive, in my opinion. So maybe a couple of good things as far as human creativity and interaction and community. And
yeah, there's going to be two paths. There's going to be the path of being consumed by the attention and dopamine economy, edutainment format, content that's all about just more. And people are going to do that and they're going to do it.
Mr. Beast.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to see people being trained to follow the algorithms, right? So you're rewarded for things going viral, whatever that is, whether it's salacious, outrageous, whether it's exploitative, right? People are going to do that more and more. They'll become more and more desensitized. That content is going to be recreated all over the place. So that is, I see, very much a track for a lot of people. And then there's a lot of other people who I see going this other track, which is what we talked about at the beginning, which is substance, deep, thoughtful, less about the rewards of notoriety, ego, millions of dollars, but it's just the fact of doing it and enjoying the process of doing it and making something really special. I think art is going to play a huge, huge, huge part in this next 18 months and the few years after of cutting through all that noise. I think it's going to get very, very, very noisy with very, very, very awful stuff based off algorithms and the AI. But I think a lot of people are-
And there's an election coming up. I mean,
which I have purposefully not mentioned. Yes, that there is
there's something happening in these next 18 months.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people are going to opt out. And so as far as, you know, what people can do, make trouble, pick your fight. What is the thing you're mad about? What is the one thing that you can't sleep at night because of it? If it is, you know, what's going to happen to creativity, put your head in the game and figure out how you're going to stand up for that fight. We are the adults in the room. So restructuring the things that we think are normal and just, you know, I tell people with technology, it's not about the detox. That's not the answer, but it is the entry point and understanding your relationship with it. Because sometimes we're so in it and under the influence of all of these different things that you don't even realize how you're operating alongside all of this stuff, why and what your triggers are. So I always tell people to just try and take some time, even if it's 24 hours without anything, get a scratch pad and write down every time you reach for your phone or your computer, or and what is the thing that you were wanting to go to. Mine, I always reach for it in small talk. So that was something really horrifying to find out about myself, is I hate small talk because I'm an introvert. And so I was trying to cut short the conversation by reaching for my phone. And the first thing I always reach for.
Wow. I want to think about that. Right? Like, what are you doing? Because there is a little twitch when I'm in a real life situation. Because it's an addiction and you're looking, where's my phone? For no reason. It's a tick.
It's pacifier. It's comforting, and it allows you to not have to do the uncomfortable human thing of connecting with someone with empathy and attention and all of that, even if it's a boring conversation. And so that was my thing. And then what is your gateway? What is the first thing you go to? So for me, because I became addicted to all of this through work, it was email, right? So I'm addicted to my phone because of these things I don't even care about anymore, which is corporations and capitalism and branding and marketing, because I was trained to be addicted to it through my email. And so that is my gateway drug. So now I have a phone that has no email on it. Crazy, right?
Yeah.
So that's what people can do. They can start to think. And that's the whole concept of the book, is you're never going to get rid of the influences. And of course, we need influence to have a functioning society, one would hope, good influences. But it's becoming aware of them. And that is the biggest thing.
It takes slowing down.
Yeah.
A lot. Slowing down a lot. Slowing down to untangle what's happened. Because it is a very insidious addiction. It doesn't ostensibly destroy your life, but it ebbs away. It's like a wave that smooths over that rock. Do your kids use Dreambox? This keeps coming up in my mind while you're talking.
What's Dreambox?
In school, my kids are in public school, and Dreambox is, they're assigned Dreambox. It's almost like a gamification of learning. They have to complete a certain...
No. Hell no. No. So this... Okay, now I'm going to get mad all over again. The gamification of anything is stupid, and it's literally just capitalism and money.
Look up Dreambox. They have to complete levels of Dreambox. It's their homework. And they go to a great school. In other ways, it's great. Yeah, but this is Wake County. I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina. Great school system. 98% of the reason why I've moved here is because the schools are so amazing. They go to a very experiential school, but this is part of the curriculum through Wake County.
So I would say to you, what is the influence? How did Dreambox become a part of the school system? And you peel back the layers, which I have laid out in the back of the book. Who benefits from having Dreambox in the school? I can guarantee you that that was a paid placement. Someone shook hands. The education department took that in. So what you need to do is say, okay, prove to me that this is educational. Prove their privacy is 100%. Is there advertising in there? They're putting them in a system to collect their data, to get them to be good consumers. The ed tech is some of the most horrifying shit. It makes my blood actually boil.
And then, I can see that. And I love it. No, I love that. That's great.
So my son's dumb phone, I'll end on this. He has a dumb phone that it's a Samsung. So it looks like a smartphone, which is very important, but it has no capability whatsoever. So when he got another year older, they had a new one that had approved apps. And I was like, okay, I'm not a monster. He has to learn how to exist in the world. Let's see what these approved apps are. We'll try. But one of them was Duolingo, which is learning another language, which I'm a traveler. Of course, I want my son to learn another language. But I wouldn't let him put his email in because now he has one. He has to have one for middle school. So I signed up with my email. He was on his phone. Thank God I had the locks on it. It was like, can I get another half hour? Can I get another half hour? I was like, whoa, what is this? I know what this is. Wait, this is like video games. No, you can't have another half hour. What's happening? And so I just stopped giving him any more time, and it stopped. He stopped playing with it so much because I turned off all the notifications and all the push notifications. The email came to me. I'm going to write about this someday. You made Duolingo sad was the email that they sent him. You these kids have so many goddamn problems. You're going to literally try and make my kid feel bad, air quotes, because he didn't play your stupid app. And then there is a bouncing Duolingo character with a sad face crying, but you can make me happy by getting back on. I'm sorry. If you have to bleep me out, I am.
That is tough.
But it's happening everywhere with everything. So this was just one little tiny.
I think you need to write a second book, more prescriptive, like a workbook. This is amazing. I will keep you apprised of when it comes out, which will be very soon. And
wonderful.
I will link to the book.
Awesome. Wonderful. I'm so happy to meet you.
I'm happy to meet you too.
Listen, tell everyone else to f off. Do your thing. Do it however you want to do it. Okay.
I'm going to end with that. I love that. Yes.
Yeah, I know, right? It's great. I am a bad influence.
You've been listening to Actual People. This show is written, directed, and executive produced by me, your host, Chauncey Zalkin. Show sound designed by Eric Aaron. Click on the link below to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And don't forget to leave a review. I'll be sharing my favorites. You can find our socials and all links to deeper dives into these topics at chaunceyzalkin.com and on my Substack at chaunceyzalkin.substack.com. Actual People is available wherever you get your podcasts.